Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina offers a summary of China news every day in your inbox or via a mobile phone app. Go to subchina.com to subscribe to the newsletter or download the app from the Apple App Store or Google Play. SubChina is a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined here in the Cynica South studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina, by Jeremy Goldcorn, heretofore undisclosed author of the state's notoriously discriminatory law, HB2, the so-called bathroom bill. Which he has actually scurrilously and hypocritically attacked on this show when everyone knows he secretly fears nothing, I say, more than he fears transgender people catching a glimpse of his privates. But you're safe here, Jeremy, in North Carolina.
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, I've got to go back to Nashville, Tennessee this afternoon, and I have no such protection there.
But your stay here has been otherwise, I mean,
it's pleasant, lovely. North Carolina is delightful.
I'm glad, and I hope you felt at home here in our new studio, our lovely digs.
Oh, yes.
So a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, as you will recall, I plugged a book called Eve of 100 Midnights. It's a book about the brief, fascinating life of the journalist Melville, or Mel Jacoby. Born in 1916 and growing up in Southern California, he attended Stanford. And during his time at that prestigious school, he spent a year in Guangzhou in Southern China and traveled around a bit, arriving in a city that was then called Beiping, just after the Marco Polo Bridge incident ignited the hot war with Japan.
After graduating from Stanford, Mel came back to China and worked as a propagandist for a nationalist government desperate to win Western sympathy for their fight against Japanese imperialism. He also worked as a journalist, both as a photographer and a correspondent in Chongqing. He managed to convince a fellow Stanford grad named Anna Lee Whitmore to join him in China. The two were married in Chongqing, and they went on to have some harrowing adventures in China and in the Philippines.
So today we're chatting with the author of that book, Bill Lasher, a Portland, Oregon-based journalist and writer. Bill, congrats on the book, which I very much enjoyed, and welcome to Cynica.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for a compliment on the book.
Bill, can you tell us about your own personal family connection to the subjects of the book, your relationship to Mel Jacoby, and how you came to be in possession of his typewriter, and perhaps something about your wonderful grandmother?
Yeah, I think I'll start with my grandmother and how I came to possession of the typewriter, because I think that will explain the connection to Mel. I was in my mid-20s, and my grandmother was moving. She was not quite a pack rat, but she had a lot of possessions. So instead of having a housewarming party, she had a house cooling when she moved, and she gave away various possessions. And one of the ones that she gave me was this box that she actually ended up giving me on Christmas. And I opened it up and I looked inside and I saw this beautiful Corona 4 typewriter manufactured in 1930. And she said to me, "This belonged to my cousin, the war correspondent." And I thought, "Your cousin, the war correspondent, who's this guy? I've never heard of him. How have I never heard of him? I had wanted to be a journalist all my life, and here I was, 24, 25, just about to start my own career as a journalist, and I hadn't known about this man who had been in my family." And as she told me about him, she unraveled this fascinating tale of this cousin that she loved. He was the oldest of, I believe it was six cousins, and 10 years older than her. She spoke with this reverence that I hadn't really heard from her before. She wasn't unemotional, but she never was particularly evocative with her emotions. And I was totally fascinating. And so over the next few years, every time I visited her, she'd tell me a little bit more about Mel, and she'd pull out another box of old letters that he'd written from China, whether from his time as an exchange student in Guangzhou or his time in Chongqing or brief time when he was in Hanoi and Haiphong in what's now Vietnam, but what was then the French Indochina. And really told me these snippets of a story that I always thought to myself, I should write a book about that. And she said the same thing, but it was always something we kept on the back burner.
Chinese are obsessed with the actual degree of relatedness to people. And we probably have a specific term for your grandmother's cousin. But your grandmother on which side and related how?
So it was my maternal grandmother. And it was
your maternal grandma.
Her first cousin. So my first cousin twice removed.
Ah, your first cousin twice removed. That's what I wanted. That's what I was going for. Jeremy, you must know the Chinese word for that now.
that is putting me on the spot. I'm afraid.
Anyway, I mean, one can almost sense that you felt kind of an invisible bond with Mel, perhaps a little projection even. I mean, maybe because of your kinship with him, you were maybe tempted to identify with him a little more than one normally does with the subject of one's researches.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think a lot of my friends and family would say that I became sort of obsessed with him. And I'd wonder what the reasoning for that was. Partially the kinship, partially the fact that as I read his letters, I came to identify with him even more and some of the emotions he had as he sort of matured over. So the book covers a course of about 5 years. And I think that it reminded me a lot of my own youth, although he accomplished a great deal more than I did then.
or any of the rest of us. I mean, we mere mortals. But were you interested in and or connected to China or East Asia, the Second World War, prior to undertaking the writing of this book?
You know, to be honest, I really wasn't. I mean, I was interested in World War II to an extent. My father had been sort of a World War II buff, the way I think a lot of fathers are. And he had, in fact, he was a little bit older, and he had enlisted in the army a few weeks before the end of World War II. And so he was always interested, but he was more interested in the European theater, and that's more what I heard about as a child and growing up. And then I studied history in undergrad, but it was sort of more focused on sort of thematic issues of sort of the articulation of national identity and nationalism. And it wasn't really focused on Asia or East Asia or China specifically. And so really, it wasn't something I was terribly familiar with. I had a brother that lived there for a year, but beyond that, I never visited.
There being China, or?
Yeah, he lived in Beijing.
Oh, cool. I wonder if I knew the guy.
It's possible.
Bill, can you tell us about the process of researching this book, what was involved? You had that spectacular trove of correspondences, but also photos and film reels. How long did you take in researching the book, and how much travel was involved?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of different answers to that question. In one sense, because I heard about the story about 10 years ago, you could say 10 years. But in terms of when I said, okay, I'm going to write a book about this and I'm going to make this sort of my full-time work, that was about 4.5 years. And that involved everything from, you know, sort of scouring those letters and photos for every clue I could, and then connecting them to library research locally and traveling to places in the U.S. like the Hoover Institution at Stanford, or the National Archives, or Teddy White's archives at Harvard, and there were also some papers at Yale. Those were all things, though, that I had to sort of squeeze into a sort of normal life of being an underemployed freelance journalist, and so I could only travel when I could, and so I tried to do as much as I could from here in Portland. I did go to China and the Philippines after I had my book deal to sort of retrace the steps that Mel took and Annalie took and see, as best as I could, the places that they had been. Although, of course, particularly in Chongqing, you know, history has sort of rapidly vanished in a way in the sort of physical form of that city. And so I was trying to get a feeling for what it was like, but also sort of how things had changed.
So let's talk about Mel and about Annalie. But let's talk first about Mel, because, you know, he's really at the center of the book. What was he all about? What made him tick? You flick at him having written some things in his personal correspondences that were maybe unkind or even flat out kind of, you know, colonial or imperialistic. But the general portrayal of him in the book is someone very deeply sympathetic with Chinese and other Asian people, and, you know, and obviously a highly talented individual. So what was Mel all about? And then let's move on to Annalie after that.
I think Mel was about, you know, he was sort of an internationalist, and he was eager to see the world from a very young age, and that became sort of more defined when he won this opportunity to go to Guangzhou. And that sort of opened his eyes to a sort of non-European culture and non-Western culture, although, of course, he was on a campus where there were a lot of other Americans. And when you talk about the sort of colonial attitudes, I think that's sort of evident in his sort of youth and arriving in China and feeling, you know, sort of a mixed attitude about, on the one hand, you know, here's this fascinating new place. On the other hand, he's sort of coming to terms with the fact that conditions were a little impoverished there. There was, you know, visibly ill people around him, and, you know, the food was quite different and things like that. And you sort of watch over the years this sort of realization that forms in his mind that, you know, he actually enjoyed those differences and appreciated them and saw the value in them. I think that if you have the opportunity to get into his mind, you see he was someone who was sort of constantly seeking, and one of the things he sought was an understanding of the rest of the world. And that carried through when he returned to Stanford, and he thought there was a strong importance in international understanding and cooperation, and that was one of the things that drove him to go back to China and to write about the war that had begun when he was there as a student, and to sort of relay that back to the United States in a way, you know, with the understanding that American media was really focused on Europe and the sort of perceived scourge that was, and real scourge that was happening in Europe in the late 1930s. But he knew that there couldn't be sort of a ignorance of what was happening in the Far East. But, you know, he evolved into a passionate journalist and to someone who really had that sense of, I don't know if I'd say a sense of justice, but at least a sense that, you know, he wasn't exactly aligned with either side, although at times he would seem sort of tightly entwined with them.
Bill, can you actually talk about perhaps some of the formative events in his thinking on China? You know, his stay in Guangzhou as a student, his travels, friendships, his early brushes with Japanese authorities, in terms of changing and shaping his worldview and his view of China. Perhaps you could mention some of the more important experiences he had.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Japanese early on after he was in what was then Beiping. He went to Japan. He went through occupied Manchuria, and he was sort of watching as best he could out windows that soldiers had sort of forced closed, and saw the sort of pouring in of troops and the militarization there. And then when he reached Japan, he witnessed a lot of rallies, a lot of that sort of sense of militarization and the sort of patriotic cause. And he had this sense of sort of being followed the whole time he was there. And I think that developed a lot of suspicions in his mind towards the Japanese that lingered when he returned to China and became quickly involved with people like Randall Gould, who was a oft-attacked journalist in Shanghai. And then he got work in Chongqing soon after that as a both as a freelance journalist, but also as a broadcaster for the nascent propaganda radio station known as XGOY, which was under the Chinese Ministry of Information. So while he's there, he's enduring things like air raids and witnessing the increasing starvation and poverty of Chongqing as the rest of the country has been pushed out of the coastal areas of China to return there. That's on one hand, but, you know, on the other hand, he also was wrestling with the Chinese government to have more access to write about the news and have access to the government. So I think those are some situations that really sort of formed his identity as wanting to publicize this war and the immense toll it was taking on the Chinese people, but also wanting to be independent enough to do his own work as a journalist.
Let's talk a bit about Anna Lee. I mean, she's absolutely fascinating, and I can't help but suspect that during the course of writing about her, this brilliant, totally self-possessed, absolutely irresistible woman, you might have developed a little bit of a crush on her, as I you know, kind of did myself. What was she all about?
Well, she was incredibly intelligent. She was the type of woman who wasn't, at a time when there was that sort of changing expectation of, you know, there's sort of the early moves of feminism, but I don't think she ever thought of herself as a feminist. She was the kind of woman who just wanted to do the work that she wanted to do. She wanted to be a journalist, and early on she was interested in playwriting, and she ended up with a job at MGM as a scriptwriter, and that was mainly through a lot of dedication and perseverance on her own. And it's tempting to say that, you know, she sort of pioneered a lot of things for women in the 1940s, but I don't think she was driven by a pioneering spirit. I think she was just driven by, she liked having an intellectual life, and she liked writing, and she thought it was important to sort of pursue the work that interested her. And that's something that I did become sort of enraptured by, was this idea that she was as sort of like individualistic as, you know, men were expected to be, and she wasn't going to let people sort of put her in her place. This included, even later in the book, Mel and Annalee ended up on Corregidor, the fortress island in the Philippines, and mm-hmm. she was sort of shuffled off into a tunnel for the women who had been evacuated there, and she refused to go there and instead wanted to be on the battlefield with Mel reporting from there, and she did do that.
That's right. That's right. So the two of them had actually been at Stanford together. They had actually worked together on the paper that the Stanford Daily, but hadn't developed any kind of a romantic relationship. That came later. And of course, that there's a love story at the very heart of the book between Annalee Whitmore, née Whitmore, who became Mel's wife.
Mel and Annalee had an amazing range of friends and acquaintances. It's almost a who's who of important figures of wartime China. Perhaps you could walk us through some of them: T.H. White, Song Meiling, Chiang Kai-shek, Douglas MacArthur, Henry Luce. It's an amazing list. Could you tell us something about how they got to know so many important people and some of those relationships?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, at first it was through chance. Early in the book, Mel met Helen Keller on a boat back from China and talked to, sort of assessed the war situation happening in East Asia at the time with her. But that was sort of a minor encounter. But over the years, you know, working for the Ministry of Information, Mel arrived in Chongqing just as Teddy White was shifting away from there and to work for Time Magazine. And the two of them became very fast friends because, you know, they were both journalists in their mid-20s, both from Jewish families, so a little isolated in their lives back home, who found a place in China and a desire to report on it, and sort of both got their first breaks there. And they quickly became best friends, living at the press hostel that was set up by Hong Tintong for foreign journalists. And, you know, aside from Teddy White, there's some other journalists like Israel Epstein there. Hugh Dean was a friend of Mel's from way back, actually, at the exchange program in Guangzhou. He was there at that first visit. He would have met Helen Foster Snow and Edgar Snow, but briefly. And so people like that were coming through the press hostel. And then through his work there and his work with the Ministry of Information and particularly his radio work, he got to know Chiang Kai-shek and Song Meiling in particular because of her interest in reaching the American people and her, you know, having been Wellesley educated. She was that sort of conduit to the U.S. And Mel set up a broadcast for her along with her two sisters and Song Meiling and Song Qingling, who he covered and took pictures of as they explored the city. When the three of them were first together in Chongqing, it was Mel who was photographing them and setting up their radio broadcasts. And that would continue, that friendship, that connection with them would continue when Annalee eventually arrived and got a job as she arrived with United China Relief, the aid organization that Henry Luce had helped set up, but really ended up as a speechwriter at first for Meiling. And then people like Henry Luce, Mel met, you know, he met him by chance on a clipper flight from the U.S. to China. And Henry Luce, having been born in China, was so interested in Mel's interest and passion for the place. And of course, Mel had known Teddy White, and that Henry Luce absolutely blown away by him on their conversations on the flight, and hired him by the time they arrived in Chongqing to work for Time. In fact, poached him from Newsweek.
Right.
So that started a great friendship. There were also people like Douglas MacArthur, who he met and, you know, lived so close to in Corregidor and during his reporting there in the Philippines. Carl Mydens, the sort of legendary life photographer, became Mel's best friend after they went to cover the fighting in China, in the interior of China, and then continued together into the Philippines until they all made a rather dramatic decision about what they were going to do as the Japanese took over the Philippines.
Which is where your book begins, right?
Mel became somewhat close to John Hersey, even, who ended up writing his first book using most of Mel's writing.
Oh, really? I did not know that. Hersey's book was based on Mel's correspondence, huh?
Yeah, his initial book, Men on Bataan, is almost entirely based on Mel's dispatches back from the Philippines. So if you were to look at Mel's dispatches and then look at Men on Bataan, you'll see that they're almost entirely, save for some reporting he did back in the United States, Mel's words.
So let's drill down a little bit about his friendship with Teddy White, who's, I mean, arguably the best known World War II correspondent who was, you know, writing from China. The two of them had, as you pointed out, kind of parallel lives for a while. They were both somewhat alienated from Jewish families, both freelancing in Chongqing, both working for the propaganda department under the Kuomintang, under Chiang Kai-shek. Talk about them. And, you know, and of course, T.H. White went on to co-author Thunder Out of China with Anna Lee afterward. What was the substance of these guys' friendship?
It was definitely the working relationship. It was this experience of having been interested in China, sharing the hardship, but also having been interested in China as students, both you know, in their undergraduate years, Teddy White at Harvard and Mel at Stanford, having traveled together a bit. They went on their way to Indochina together, although Teddy White continued on while Mel stayed to report on the Japanese occupation there. And then they continued a correspondence even when Teddy White was back in the United States. Mel would sort of use Teddy White as his filter as he wrote to places like Time Magazine. He would write him, you know, he would send his dispatches back to Teddy, and then Teddy would look at them and use his understanding of China to then, you know, contribute to the rewriting of these articles that Time printed. You know, Time didn't use bylines on its articles. It sort of considered them all sort of the product of the editorial team. So Teddy gave Mel access to make sure that the dispatches that he sent from China were printed as accurately as possible in Time, although even then, as people like Whitaker Chambers gained more influence, what would happen there at Time Magazine would get sort of further and further distorted the further away it got from the source.
So my father actually grew up in wartime Chongqing. You know, he grew up romancing on the stories about the Flying Tigers. He was born in 32, so when the war, you know, started, he was still quite young, but they moved to Chongqing shortly after, well, I guess it was in the late summer of 1937. But he was, you know, watching the dogfights, telling me always about the bomb shelters. In fact, you know, he describes exactly the same system of lanterns that you have in the book, watching them from the slope of Songlingpo in Shapingba in Chongqing, watching the lanterns go up and then packing up his father's manuscript, his baby brother on his back, you know, hustle off to the bomb shelters. He also told me, and I remember hearing about this when I was a boy, that night of absolute horror that was documented, as it turns out, by Mel, you know, giving me a bit of a personal connection to this. So tell us about the bomb shelter tragedy of June 5th, 1941, and what role Mel played in publicizing it and the horror surrounding it.
Yeah, this was a just horrifying disaster where Chongqing was bombed, I think, 168 times during the time that Mel was there. And this disaster on June 5th, 1941 was by far the worst thing he experienced. He was safe in a press hostel bomb shelter, he was probably on the south side of the river at that point, because the press hostel had been bombed a number of times. But anyhow, he was there to witness the recovery effort after the shelter had been... The particular raid had involved incendiary bombs, and thousands of people weren't able to get to their shelters in time, or the shelters in many cases, as is the case in this one shelter, which was the large municipal shelter, the gates had been locked as successive waves of planes came. So there were people rushing to get into this shelter, yet at the same time, because the shelter had been overcrowded and because it wasn't built with proper ventilation systems, there were thousands of people within the shelter who were trying to get out, but again, the gates were locked. And so there were stampedes in both directions, and in the aftermath of these stampedes, there was an sort of indescribably gruesome scene, which Mel describes in vivid detail that shows up in his dispatches back to Time Magazine. You know, people clawing at each other, people tearing at each other's skin, at each other's clothes. And then, of course, the sight of bodies, even the next morning, just piled high outside of the entrances of these shelters.
And he took photos, right?
He took photos of this and sent them back. One of the photos is this iconic photo of bodies piled along a staircase, you know, in various stages of just destruction. And it was so horrible and so horrifying that in the U.S., you know, Life magazine ran some of these photos, and in the U.S. they were getting letters claiming that the photos couldn't be real, that they were propaganda, that they were mannequins that had been staged along the staircases to sort of amp up the drive to war and the push for war. Of course, this was 6 months before Pearl Harbor, so the U.S. was still sort of nominally neutral, even though it was sending aid to China. And so it was sort of literally an unbelievable tragedy. And I believe the number is 4,000 people who died in this one bombing, although at the time, you know, officials were really trying to downplay that, saying a couple hundred people had died. And Mel had reported on the fact that the officials were being questioned quite harshly by doctors and engineers who knew that, you know, there wasn't proper construction of this shelter, and that there hadn't been the right ventilation, and that hadn't been built in a way that would sustain the, you know, ongoing pummeling. And it's a tragedy that's still recognized somewhat in Chongqing. There's a monument to it there, although it's surrounded by a mall. But it's one of those
like everything is in China.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a tragedy, though, that Americans know about and that most people in the West, I think, know about. I think we know about the Blitz in London, and we know about things like the firebombing of Dresden and catastrophes like that. But for some reason, there's this gap in our understanding of what happened in China from 1937 to 1945.
Bill, Mel was really a multimedia journalist a long time before that rather awkward word was used. He was an accomplished photographer and an avid user of 8mm film. Can you tell us a little bit about his photography and his filmmaking and, you know, how much of these materials are survived?
Yeah, he did most of the filming, most of the 8mm filming when he was in Guangzhou, so before he was really working as a journalist, but I've seen about an hour's worth of film that at some point had been digitized, probably in the early 80s. I shouldn't say digitized, it was transferred to VHS, and then I digitized that later. But there was a tiny bit from Chongqing, but maybe 5 or 10 minutes worth of just sort of random scenery there. So that's the film. I think he was interested in it, and he was sort of curious about it, but my impression from his letters was that he, you know, preferred still photography still. But he really was eager to learn as much as he could about still photography and to take pictures, especially when he was traveling with Carl Maidens. He asked him for an education in what he was doing. And, you know, some of these photos are quite stunning pictures of daily life in Chongqing, and then also pictures of bombings and bomb damage and some degree of military activity, although not a great number of that, a great amount of that. At one point, he was taking pictures in Haiphong, a coastal city in Vietnam, of a warehouse that the Japanese were occupying. And his sort of passion to get the right shot there got him arrested by the Japanese and briefly accused of being a spy alongside an American diplomat. And so, you know, he was willing to take risks to get photos. And he continued to take photos on the Bataan Peninsula and on Corregidor, and then on the Great Escape that he and Annalee had. They were some of the first photos that the U.S. saw of the fighting that was happening in the Philippines. And that was important to him. Although he was a great writer and he was always improving his writing, I think had circumstances been a little different, he might have really continued his life as a photographer and got interested in that. He also did a little bit of that radio reporting for the propaganda station and did more for NBC. So you could really say he was multimedia with the film and the radio and the writing and the photography.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of the experiences that Mel and Annalee had after escaping Manila. As you said, they were actually on Bataan, on the Bataan Peninsula, of course, before the Death March, and on Corregidor with MacArthur and his troops. They were, you know, living in the caves and enduring the ceaseless Japanese attack. Tell us about those days for the couple. I mean, they were still newlyweds. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it was essentially their honeymoon. They had been married a week or so before Pearl Harbor. And so they knew that war was coming and that signs of war were very imminent. And so as soon as Pearl Harbor happened and within hours the Philippines were attacked, they got to work and worked alongside one another. Mel was writing for Time and Life, and Anna Lee was writing for an outfit called Liberty Magazine, but also supplying some additional reporting to help Mel out. And Mel knew, because of his previous work with the Chinese government, that he was probably on a Japanese blacklist. So when it was clear that the Japanese were going to occupy Manila, he had to make a decision of whether to stay and hope that he could be kept under house arrest or maybe risk an escape. So he and Anna Lee fled along with a man named Clark Lee, who'd reported in Shanghai. And the three of them got onto the very last boat leaving Manila at just after midnight on New Year's Eve. In fact, they were on the harbor when New Year's Eve struck, and didn't know where they were going, but ended up the next morning on Corregidor, where they continued for 6 weeks or so reporting on the defense of the Philippines that was centered at Corregidor, and traveling with American troops to Bataan to see the sort of ragtag defense that was occurring there with the Americans that were hunkered down there and the Filipino scouts that were there. And they reported on things like the jungle hospitals that had been built there to treat soldiers, and the American nurses that were helping out at those jungle hospitals. There's sort of an iconic photo of the American nurses bathing after working all day that Anna Lee had taken. And again, as I think I mentioned, they were able to eventually bring back some of the first photos that came to the U.S. from these places, so that the Americans could sort of see what this war that had been sort of distant and isolated, you know, was like. And, you know, that isolation was important. The place was surrounded. The Japanese controlled the waterways around every part of the Philippines. And so when it finally became clear that Corregidor and Bataan were going to fall, they were told about a boat that was leaving, a blockade runner that was sneaking in at night to deliver a shipment of rice. And they got passage on that boat and proceeded to sail sort of island to island and hiding out
by night.
Right. Yeah, sailing by night and hiding out by day. And, you know, they were chased. There were reconnaissance planes and submarines and destroyers. And that's sort of the last sort of climactic point of the book, I guess.
Before the very sad denouement.
And, you know, speaking of the sad denouement, what happened to Anna Lee after...
Let's not spoil the...
Yeah, I'm not going to ask you to describe the surprise, well, not surprise, the ending of the book. But what happened to Anna Lee after, what's the post story?
Well, as you guys have implied, there's a rather sad turn. And, you know, Anna Lee and Mel were eventually separated, and I'll leave it at that. Anna Lee returned to the United States and... of course, was troubled at first, but ultimately, you know, sort of just like Mel, she just wanted to get back to China as quickly as she could once she recovered. And she went back to work with the Time organization and aided again in part by Teddy White sort of speaking up for her. And he had met her and Mel in Australia, and the two of them had sort of, that was his first encounter with Anna Lee. And of course, he was sort of just as taken with her as Mel was, and the two worked together very closely. And they ended up going back to China and working for Time for a few years, or a couple years, but at that time, the conditions were unraveling even further than they had been when Mel was there. And the tensions, of course, had started to tighten between the communists and the Kuomintang, and Teddy and Anna Lee were quite critical of Chiang Kai-shek, and Henry Luce had been incredibly loyal to Chiang Kai-shek and was outraged at their criticisms and their critiques, and ended up forcing Anna Lee to quit. And the two of them, Teddy and Anna Lee, ended up writing Thunder Out of China after being squeezed out of the Time organization. And
right,
it was a bestseller, probably one of the best books at the time written about that era in Chinese history. And the attention from that book ended up putting Anna Lee in the orbit of Clifton Fadiman, who ran the Book of the Month Club. And eventually the two of them would become married and live the rest of their lives together.
So, I mean, obviously in Thunder Out of China, which, you know, Anna Lee co-wrote, there's a great deal about Mao and the communists. And as you said, a lot of criticism of Jiang. But in the book, it's not really clear how much Mel, while he was still with us, actually knew or what he actually thought about the communists at Yan'an. What did you learn in your research about what Mel thought of Mao and his movement?
I'd say he was sort of ambivalent, not quite skeptical. I think he was eager to meet them and learn a little bit more about them. When he was traveling through China in 1937, right as the war started, he almost went to Yan'an, and then because of the start of the war, he had to rush back to Beiping to make sure he could get on a ship back to the United States and make sure he could get out of the country before war really erupted. So he wasn't able to make that trip, but I think he was always sort of curious about the communists. He was, however, sympathetic to Kuomintang, and he made friends there and he worked with them. But in Chongqing during the war, you know, Chou Enlai worked there and occasionally briefed the journalists that were working there. And there's an impression I get from Mel's dispatches and letters that he was open to hearing what they had to say, but he mm-hmm. didn't seem to have a strong opinion either way in terms of, you know, what their goals were, what their role was. I think he was so focused on the war and the sort of progression of the war that he didn't develop a strong opinion. However, he did develop the same frustration that other journalists had with the Kuomintang's effort to control the message. And he was one of a number of signatories of foreign journalists to formally petition Chiang Kai-shek's government for more access.
Well, the book is called Eve of 100 Midnights, and the author, Bill Lasher, was kind enough to join us. Thanks, Bill. That was terrific. And I can't tell you how much, I mean, whether you're interested in journalism, in the war, in whatever your particular angle of interest is, this is a book that I would very, very much recommend. And if you want to see some photography by and of Mel and Annalie Jacoby, please make sure to check out our podcast page. And Bill, meanwhile, I hope you'll stick around and make a recommendation for our listeners with us.
Absolutely.
So before we get to recommendations, I do want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SubChina on Twitter at SubChinaNews and on Facebook at facebook.com/SubChinaNews. And if you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, do leave us a positive review on the Apple App Store or on Google Play or wherever you go to review apps.
And actually, if you don't like the Seneca podcast, you can leave us a positive review too. We won't mind.
Anyway, it really does help us, and it means a lot to us, doesn't it, Jeremy?
It does indeed.
So, on to recommendations. Jeremy, why don't you kick us off?
Okay, one of my favorite things to do when visiting a new city is to turn on WeChat and use the look around, the people nearby function, and check out how many Chinese people are in the immediate vicinity. And obviously, there are a lot of them in California, Southern California, and so I'd like to recommend an article in the LA Times by David Pearson, who used to be in Beijing and I think is, you know, writing back in LA now, called "This App Fuels the Illicit Trade of Dumplings and Pork Knuckles in Southern California," which makes it sound a bit more sinister than it is, but it's basically about how home cooks are selling their delicious Chinese delicacies using WeChat in Southern California. And of course, it's a completely unregulated business. But I hope nobody decides to clamp down on it. And I hope this becomes popular in Nashville, where I live and where there's a terrible scarcity of Chinese restaurants.
That's funny. I hadn't seen that article, but I was going to pitch that idea. I mean, there's this here in Chapel Hill, the whole triangle area, there is a fishmonger. They sell fish out of the back of their car, really fresh, excellent shrimp, and there's the sorts of fish that Chinese people like, crab, lobster, whatever. And I'm sure they're not paying taxes or meeting health inspections, but it's cheap and very fresh, and they do it entirely through WeChat as well.
There is one more thing, if I may make two recommendations.
Absolutely.
Just because I've been thinking about it, because I saw this book on your bookshelf, Kaiser, that is one of my favorite books. Not a China recommendation. It's called The State of Africa, A History of the Continent Since Independence. The author is Martin Meredith. And if you are interested in knowing a little bit about the whole continent, it is probably the best single volume you could read that will give you a great overview of many, many countries in the African continent and how they've fared since independence from the colonial powers.
Yeah, I love that book. And, it's, you know, it comprises basically the sum total of what I know about Africa. But yeah, a great book, great recommendation.
More than most Americans, I have discovered. so, but anyway, that book is an excellent introduction. And even if you know a lot about Africa, it's a very good book.
Low bar, man, low bar. Bill, you're up. What do you have for us?
Well, I've recently been reading a book that maybe was recommended by someone on this podcast before, but Janice Y.K. Lee's The Expatriates. She's a Korean-American woman, born in Hong Kong, and it's a novel about the experience of being an expatriate in Hong Kong, written from the perspective of, I'm only about halfway through it, but the perspective so far of three different women. And it's just an excellently written novel that isn't the sort of novel I would normally pick up. I had heard a snippet of it read on some podcast and was so captivated by it that I picked it up from the library and have just been devouring it this past week. And I look forward to finishing it. It's really incredibly descriptive. And it, though I have only been in Hong Kong for a few days, it brought out the experience of being an expatriate anywhere. That something that I wanted to think about. And then I also thought I might recommend this article that was written last week or so in the New York Times by Chris Buckley about the Jewish population in Kaifeng and their sort of increasing sense of pressure from the Chinese government. And I've always been fascinated with that tiny Jewish population in China and sort of its history and how it got there. And I think this article really sort of evokes that sense of fascination, but also the sort of question of what's in store for a religion that really sort of wasn't experiencing as much trouble as other religions in modern China.
You know, my dad was actually born in that quarter, in the area where the Kaifeng Jews live. His family's not actually from Kaifeng. So, I mean, we
you're not actually Jewish.
I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm not.
I know.
Culturally, I am, maybe, but not ethnically. My dad was born on a street called Tiaojing Hutong. Tiaojing means pick out the tendon, which is, you know, was named after this particular dietary observation of this sect that was believed to be some sort of, you know, strange offshoot of Islam by most of the other people there. Of course, they found out later that they were in fact Jewish. My little brother persists in the belief that we actually are Jewish. I've tried to disabuse him of this.
So. Well, he lives in New York, I guess.
Yeah, on the Upper West Side.
Give him some credit.
Works
something.
In theater. He's gay, so, you know, hey, well. Anyway, my recommendation actually does connect to Mel and Annalie through the person of Clifton Fadiman, who is the editor of the publication I'm to recommend in the 1970s, sort of at its height, and at the time that I was reading it. It's called Cricket Magazine. And for those of you with children who you hope to interest in literature, there's really nothing better for it. I loved it. I mean, it I think, got me interested in, you know, the life of letters. It's got poetry in it. It's got terrific little short stories, and it's not insulting to the child at all. It's you know, pretty. It exposes you to some pretty sophisticated stuff. It's got a couple of sort of precursors. I think one's called Spider. I didn't read these or even know about them. I started reading Cricket probably in fifth or sixth grade, and read it for a few years, and you know, I had they would send you after your annual subscription an LP that I used to have that had Clifton Fadiman actually reading some poetry and maybe a short story. It was great.
I remember its existence. I think maybe one of my brothers had it, but I don't remember anything distinct about it.
Well, it's a hell of a lot better than like Highlights or Boy's
Absolutely.
Life. I mean, it's great stuff. Anyway, one more recommendation since you guys are all doing two. I'm gonna do two as well. The book Wonder, since we're talking about children's literature, by R.J. Palacio, which I'm kind of late to, but you know, but my son Johnny is reading the book now, and you know, once in a while we read it together. It seems to be really, really quite profoundly affecting. It's about a kid. It's told, the first part of it anyway, later on shifts narrative voice. A kid who has, you know, was born with all sorts of, I mean, he has a cleft palate, and that's just maybe the least of his medical conditions that he has at age 10. has already endured like 27 surgeries, and he's off to he was homeschooled up until this point, but now he's dealing with a private school. Really, very, very good writing. I'm very impressed. Anyway, thanks again, Bill.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure, and I look forward to hanging out sometime. Jeremy, great to have you, man. It was so good to have you out here in North Carolina.
Yeah, because of the bathrooms.
Yeah, it comes to an end. It comes to an end today, and off you go back home. But great to see you. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Special thanks this week to Anla Cheng, Amadeo Tumalulo, and Soraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast. And follow us on Twitter at SenecaPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.